Hitler's War by David Irving. Hitler goes to ground. Schopenhauer identified a certain rare character whom fate has raised from total obscurity to eminence, and who ever afterward believes that the same forces will never wholly desert him in his hour of misfortune, that no abyss is really bottomless, but that when he has plumbed its depths, he will once again be lifted to the heights. Such a man was Hitler. The race between East and West to reach Berlin had convinced him that the two world hemispheres must within months be at war with each other, a war from which Germany would emerge as the Tertius Gaudens. Had his war lasted the full 7 years, he might indeed have reaped the Cold War's rewards. Until the very last days of his life, his intelligence experts would nourish his beliefs with evidence of the coming conflict. A group of Soviet agents parachuted into Templin on the night of April 7th to 8th, 1945, admitted under interrogation that their mission had been to find out what plans the Allies had made for attacking the Russians. If even Stalin expected such a clash, then Hitler intended to keep his Reich in existence, however battered and however diminished, until then. Since late February 1945, Hitler and his staff had spent their nights in the Reich Chancellery's bunker. The main shelter lay becalmed and impregnable, compared to, by Schaub, to a U-boat prowling the depths below Berlin's sea of houses and ministry buildings, quote-unquote. Such was the scene of this final chapter of Hitler's life, with its narrow passageway, the constant hum of air-conditioning machinery, and the throng of military and party officials clinging to Hitler and his infectious belief that this crisis would be overcome. There's an asterisk. Thus, Admiral Dönitz advised his commanders on March 3, 1945, quote, "Let us place our trust unconditionally in Adolf Hitler's leadership. Believe me, in my 2 years as Navy Commander-in-Chief, I have found that his strategic views always turned out right." End quote. The right of passageway after the machine room was Bormann's office. With the main telephone switchboard and his teleprinters. The office was wallpapered with maps of Germany and Berlin, on which a 5-man unit marked in blue China graph pencil the progress of each enemy bomber stream. Here, Hitler spent the hours of the big alerts, watching with tired eyes the arrows approaching Berlin. The British bombers attacked from behind, blinding the quote-unquote screens of radio jamming, while the quote-unquote fast raiding forces mounted diversionary attacks. Since the Holocaust of Dresden, British night bomber forces had cascaded incendiaries and explosives into Chemnitz, Duisburg, Worms, Kassel, and ancient Würzburg. By day, the tide was beginning to turn, as the ME-262 jets joined the squadrons. On a typical day, the grim pages of the Luftwaffe High Command's war diary reported, quote, 4 ME-262s shot down 4 bombers, end quote. General Dietrich Peltz, 9th Air Corps, and Colonel Hajo Hermann, 9th Fighter Division, had secured, in February, Goering's permission to prepare a mass attack by suicide pilots on American bomber formations. The kamikaze operation, overlooked by history, was vivid proof of the bitterness fomented by the bombing war. Color made available 180 ME-109s on April 3rd. 184 pilots volunteered. The battle took place west of Hanover on April 7th, 1945. Of the quote-unquote suicide ME-109s, 133 were lost after destroying 23 American bombers. 77 pilots were killed. The jet fighters escorting these hopeless heroes claimed 28 more American bombers that day. Left of the red-carpeted main passageway in Hitler's bunker were his private rooms, a bedroom with army bed, wardrobe, chest of drawers, and safe, and a low-ceilinged living room with a desk, table, and hard sofa. A portrait of his idol, Friedrich the Great, hung over the desk. Between the bedroom and the passageway was the small conference room, filled with a map table surrounded by a wooden bench. Through the doors at the passageway's far end, a spiral staircase led up to the Chancellery Gardens. This bunker was connected to the Voss bunker under the Chancellery, which could house 2,000 people. In 1939, Hitler had opened it to Berlin's hospital and welfare services, and many an quote-unquote Adolf, had cried its first cries of life there. The birth being marked by flowers for the mother and a bank book with 100 marks for the child. Every evening now, a line formed in the street for access to the Voss bunker. Hitler personally ordered a concrete rain shelter built for those waiting, but weeks later his order had still not been carried out. Quote, I have to attend to every minor detail. Oh, there's a illustration of the bunker. I have to attend to every minor detail myself, he remarked angrily to his secretaries, and yet there's nobody suitable as a successor. End quote. Fräulein Schroeder, the sharpest of these ladies, pointed out, quote, the name of Herr Himmler is often mentioned by the people. The man's got no artistic sense at all, retorted Hitler, to which Fräulein Schroeder tartly replied, quote, in our present straits, artistic sense hardly matters, end quote. Over 1 million people had been slain by the Allied bombers. One day early in April 1945, Bormann read to Hitler an Allied newspaper report about German troops having saved an American bomber crew about to be lynched by angry townsfolk after a raid. Hitler was furious and looked at General Köhler standing to the left of his chair. Quote, these are the men who are murdering German women and children. It's incredible. End quote. He turned to Kaltenbrunner. Quote, I order that all bomber crews shot down these last few months or in the future are to be turned over to the SD at once and liquidated. End quote. He buttonholed Köhler a few minutes later and appealed to him. Quote, you must help me. We can't go on like this. What am I to do against this nightmare terror bombing and the murder of our women and children? End quote. Köhler urged patience. Quote, when our jet squadrons get stronger, the war in the air over Germany will turn in our favor again. End quote. Hitler replied, quote, I cannot wait till then. If these airmen realize that in the future they will be liquidated as terrorists, they'll think twice about whether to fly over. End quote. Köhler responded that neither the Luftwaffe nor the SD would lend themselves to such an order. The failure to enforce this latest order showed again that Hitler's authority was crumbling. Yet another instance was his minister's unauthorized peace feelers to the enemy. Ribbentrop sent his English affairs expert Fritz Hesse to Stockholm, and when the Swedish press exposed Hesse's mission on March 15th, earning for Ribbentrop a thunderous rebuke from Hitler. A few days later, the foreign minister again sent Werner von Schmieden to Switzerland and consul Eitel Friedrich Mulhausen to Madrid to seek terms for a halt to the, quote, frightful bombing and carnage, end quote. Hitler halted all such feelers, causing Reichsmarschall Goering to refer to his stubbornness in a private conversation late in March. In his diary, General Köhler noted that when he complained about the lack of clear directives from Hitler, quote, the Reichsmarschall agreed. He is just as much in the dark. Führer tells him nothing. Nor is it permissible to make the slightest political move. For example, the attempt of a British diplomat in Sweden to contact us was strictly rebuffed by F. The Führer flatly forbids Reichsmarschall to make any use of his own comprehensive contacts abroad. Again and again, the foreign minister Ribbentrop submits fresh possibilities to F, but he just turns them down. End quote, and there's an asterisk. Count Lutz Schwerin von Krosigk also noted in his diary a talk with Goebbels on April 9, 1945, in which Goebbels described how Germany had put out cautious peace feelers. The Russians and Americans had reacted positively, but the British had rejected them out of hand. Back up. In the West, all attempts at destroying the Remagen Bridge across the Rhine failed until it was too late. By the time that German naval frogmen and jet bombers had brought it down, the Americans had brought another bridge in service. On the night of March 22nd, American amphibious tanks sprang yet another bridgehead across the Rhine at Oppenheim. At 3 a.m. on the 24th, Montgomery's main Rhine crossing began at Wesel. By March 28th, it was clear that the Ruhr was about to be encircled. Whole companies of German troops were throwing away their weapons and deserting. On the Baltic coast, Kullberg had fallen in mid-March after holding out against the Polish and Russian enemy, long enough for 60,000 of the port civilians to escape by sea. The civilian evacuation of Königsberg and Danzig was in full swing. In Hungary, the counterattacks in which Hitler had vested his hopes had failed dismally. The speed of events, particularly in the West, stunned Hitler. He had been confident that in the East a great German defensive triumph lay in store. On March 25th, he told Gauleiter Fritz Sauckel that for the first time he feared the war was lost. Captured American troop indoctrination manuals had reached the Chancellery. As one Führer adjutant wrote, quote, "The implacable hatred preached in them against the entire German nation seems little short of the Old Testament language to me," end quote. Early in April, Hitler was shown a British manual for an operation ominously codenamed Eclipse. It named numerous categories of Germans for quote-unquote automatic arrest, and contained maps of the ultimate dissection of Germany and Berlin into occupation zones. Brief German reconquests of ground in East Prussia brought fresh reports on the fate of the Germans who had not escaped in time. Quote, "It shall not be. These illiterate brutes shall not inundate all Europe," Hitler raged. "I am the last bulwark against this peril. If there is any justice, then we shall emerge victorious. One day the world will see the moral of this struggle." End quote. And yes, it will. Defeat seemed certain to all but the most blindly loyal. The hours that Hitler spent with them increased. Dr. Robert Ley, leader of the Labor Front, was now favored with many hours of Hitler's private conversation. He left Berlin inflated with new courage and conviction to organize an Adolf Hitler-free corps in Austria, tank-killer teams trained and equipped to operate behind the Russian lines. Quote, "The Führer was head and shoulders above us all," wrote Ley after the war, "and we were too puny for this titan," end quote. On March 20th, Hitler finally relieved the Reichsführer of command of the Army Group Vistula. Quote, "The Führer saw through Himmler," wrote Ley. "I had a long talk with the Führer at the time, in which he bitterly complained of Himmler's disobedience, dishonesty, and incompetence," end quote. Fundamental to Hitler's predicament was that many of his generals and ministers were already secretly window dressing for the war crimes trials they regarded as inevitable. Gotthard Heinrichi, the mild-mannered, church-going general whom Hitler appointed as Himmler's successor, for want of any better army group commanders, lacked the wholehearted commitment of a Schirner or Model. Field Marshal Model held out with Army Group B, Rommel's old command, in the encircled Ruhr pocket until his guns had spent their last ammunition. He then took his own life to cheat the enemy. This was the spirit which had saved Stalin's Russia in 1941 and 1942. But Hitler's other lieutenants lacked even the will to cheat the enemy of the spoils of war. The arms factories of Upper Silesia fell intact to Russian hands. In January 1945, Speer had not hesitated to order the destruction of Hungarian refineries, a premature act that the OKW was just able to stop in time. By March, he was planning less for Germany's defense than for his own. His character was ambivalent and complex. Later, he would claim that he had, quote, "counted up all the acts of high treason which he had committed from the end of January onward, and had arrived at a total of over 60, end quote. Hitler never realized this. Disappointed by the failure of the ME-262 jet aircraft production, he appointed SS General Hans Kammler to take charge. Speer was convinced, however, that his master's war was lost. In a memorandum to Hitler, he stated that the enemy air raids and the loss of the coal-bearing regions made, quote, "final economic collapse," unquote, inevitable within 4 to 8 weeks. Quote, "After this collapse, the war cannot even be militarily continued," end quote. His memorandum urged Hitler to remember the government's obligation to its people. He demanded strict orders prohibiting the destruction of factories and bridges, as this could now only harm Germany. Hitler recognized this document for what it was. He told Guderian he had stuffed it, quote, unread, unquote, into the man-high safe at the foot of his bed. He merely indulged Speer when he again argued these points late on March 18th. Speer was an intellectual, foreign to the dictates of strategy, and it was the minister's 40th birthday the next day. But his indulgence cooled when he learned a week later through party channels that Speer had secretly driven to the West to sabotage Hitler's orders for a scorched earth policy to slow down the Allied advance. Hitler had issued these orders on March 19th, after Keitel's orders issued in January had failed to prevent the scandalous events of Upper Silesia and the Saar. Hitler's directive called for the destruction of all military transportation, communications, and public utility installations, quote, "insofar as they may be of use to the enemy in the furtherance of his fight," end quote. Visiting the West, Spear had spread despondency and gloom, infecting everybody he met and urging them to turn their factories over to the enemy intact. Walking for an hour alone with Goebbels in the Chancellery Garden on March 27th, Hitler revealed that he had decided to remain in Berlin. The propaganda minister afterwards lamented that Bormann and Speer had talked Hitler out of the plan to repudiate the Geneva Convention after the Dresden raid. His soldiers would have had no option but to fight then. Late the next day, the Führer received Speer and coldly instructed him to stand down as armaments minister, since he clearly lacked the necessary faith that the tide could still turn in their favor. Speer flushed and protested, but Hitler challenged him outright. Quote, "Do you still hope for a successful continuation of the war, or is your faith shattered?" End quote. When after 24 hours Speer had still not given him a straight answer, Hitler effectively sacked him, although he continued to value his presence at the Chancellery as a friend. He told Goebbels afterward that Speer was now too much in the pocket of big business. He was thinking too much of his future. Yodel cut from a different cloth, and his military staff attempted in a new OKW order to put Hitler's defense doctrines into practice, instilling into the Western Army Group commanders the need to bring home to the enemy that they were plunging into a German, quote, fanatical with fighting spirit. A Germany fanatical with fighting spirit, end quote. Quote, "This is not the time or place for considering the civilian population," the order concluded, and end quote. Bormann adds his own characteristic warning to his Gauleiters. Quote, "Devil take the one who deserts his Gau under the enemy attack, except with express orders from the Führer, or who does not fight to the last breath in his body. He will be cast out as a deserter and dealt with accordingly." End quote. Heinrich Himmler's fall from grace was more spectacular. His SS Panzer Army in Hungary and SS General Sepp Dietrich had failed. Quote, "Punctuously," assessed Hitler, speaking of the Reichsfuhrer to Goebbels, "but no warlord." End quote. Nothing could stop the Russians from pouring into Vienna. The Hungarian oil fields were lost. Quote, "If we lose the war, it will be his fault," Hitler raged, and he ordered that as a punishment, Dietrich's principal divisions were to be stripped of their insignia for 3 days. Himmler was packed off to Vienna like a schoolboy, ordered to reprimand his Waffen-SS generals. General Guderian's dismissal as chief of staff, the next upheaval, resulted from a similar defeat just east of Berlin. Since mid-March 1945, he had been preparing a limited counterattack toward Küstrin from his own Frankfurt bridgehead, hoping to destroy the enemy assault forces massing for the attack on Berlin. But before General Theodor Busse's Ninth Army could begin the counterattack, the Russians struck and encircled Küstrin completely. Busse's own attack on March 22nd failed. Hitler insisted that it be repeated immediately. General Heinrichi came to the bunker in person on March 25th to argue lamely for Küstrin to be abandoned to the enemy so that he could conserve what ammunition and gasoline he had for the big defensive battles ahead. But again, Hitler insisted on a policy of attack. A purely defensive stance would allow the Russians to pounce at will. The new attack began on March 28th. The German tanks reached Küstrin's outskirts, but once again the infantry failed to follow through, and the tanks were brought back. Against Hitler's explicit orders, the Küstrin garrison then broke out to the west, knifing through the Russian lines, which Heinrichi and Busse had both described as impenetrable. Hitler summoned General Busse to the bunker and informed him of his displeasure. Guderian loudly and intemperately defended him, purpling with rage. Hitler cleared the bunker conference room and advised Guderian, quote, "You need sick leave. I don't think your heart can stand the strain. Come back in 6 weeks," end quote. He told Goebbels that the chief of general staff had become, quote, "hysterical and fidgety," unquote. Guderian had messed up the whole Eastern Front. He had lost his nerve just as at Moscow in the winter of 1941. Warily, because he knew Hitler's loathing of astrologers, Dr. Goebbels had sent for the horoscopes of the Republic, November 9th, 1918, and of the Führer, January 30th, 1933, which the Gestapo had kept filed away. That morning, March 30th, 1945, he established, quote, "Both horoscopes agree to a stunning degree. They could be interpreted," end quote. They could be interpreted as having already predicted the outbreak of war in 1939, the victories until 1941, and the hammer blows of defeat since then. The hardest blows, they prophesized, would fall in his first half of April, in this first half of April, while the second half would temporarily give Germany the upper hand again. A period of stalemate would follow until August 1945, in which month peace would return. After three cruel years, the horoscopes concluded, Germany's ascent to greatness would be resumed in 1948. Determined to persuade Hitler to speak one more time to the German nation, Goebbels descended into the Chancellery bunker on March 30th. Quote, "The Führer," he wrote in his diary, "now has a completely incomprehensible fear of the microphone." End quote. Hitler explained that first he wanted a military victory in the West. In view of the new wave of desertions, there he now regretted having turned down Goebbels' suggestion that they repudiate the Geneva Convention. Quote, "He says he allowed Keitel, Bormann, and Himmler to talk him out of it," Goebbels noted. And end quote. The minister therefore opted for a different tack. A month earlier, he had said he had obtained a copy of Thomas Carlyle's magnificent work on Frederick the Great, and he told Hitler now how deeply it had moved him. Quote, "What an example for us all," Goebbels had written on the 5th, "and what a source of consolation and inspiration in these difficult times." End quote. Now he came to the shelter and read aloud to Hitler in his melodious and dramatic voice from Carlyle's fine description of the darkest hours of the Seven Years' War. There came the moment in which Friedrich the Great saw no way out. His generals were convinced of imminent defeat, and Prussia's enemies already gloated over her fall. The great king proclaimed in a letter to Count de Argensen that if the tide had not turned by a certain date, he would accept defeat and swallow poison. Here Carlyle apostrophized, according to Goebbels, quote, "Brave king, tarry a while, because your days of travail will soon pass. Already the sun has risen behind the clouds of your misfortune, and soon it will shine forth." End quote. 3 days before the king's deadline, the Tsarina Elizabeth had died. The accession of Peter III to the throne took Russia out of the war, and thus the House of Brandenburg was saved. Goebbels saw tears starting in his Führer's eyes as he laid the book aside. Later that day, on March 30th, Hitler issued a clear-sighted appraisal of the situation. Quote, "Now that we have failed to shatter the enemy preparations by counterattack," end quote. He ordered General Heinrichi to construct a quote-unquote main battle line 2 to 4 miles behind the front line, a bitter lesson he had learned from the Americans on the dawn of his own Ardennes offensive. The moment the Russian offensive was seriously anticipated, Heinrichi was to fall back on his second line. The huge enemy artillery bombardment would then fall on the empty trenches of the original front line. Heinrichi was also ordered to recite his artillery farther back, where it could saturate the countryside between the present front and the main battle line when the Russian attack began. Thus, Hitler's malevolently brilliant brain was still functioning logically and flexibly. His doctors were later unanimous in agreeing that his sanity remained intact until the end, even though his bloodshot eyes had now become so poor that he had to put on spectacles to read even the documents typed on the special big-face typewriters. His hair had turned an ashen gray, and Morell observed in Hitler for the first time, fœtor exsorre, the clinical description of bad breath. A year before, this man had held all of Europe from the North Cape to the Crimea and the Spanish frontier in his thrall. Now millions of enemy troops were only an hour's drive away, east and west of his capital, and his headquarters was this shelter. Yet the admiration of his strategic advisers was unimpaired. Quote, "Looking at the whole picture," General Jodl unashamedly told his interrogators, "I am convinced that he was a great military leader. Certainly no historian can say that Hannibal was a poor general just because ultimately Carthage was destroyed." End quote. For Hitler, the springtime had brought encouraging signs for the future, which blinded him to the remorseless approach of the enemy armies. His jet reconnaissance planes had reopened the skies over England and Scotland. On March 17th, the first Mark 21 submarine had set forth, bound for the east coast of the United States. In February, Stalin had lost 4,600 tanks against a monthly output of only 2,300. In the first 22 days of March, no fewer than 5,452 Soviet tanks were claimed destroyed. Quote, "The enemy reserves will shortly be exhausted," the General Staff assured the Führer. In the beleaguered fortresses of Breslau and Königsberg, German garrisons were still holding out. Quote, "And as long as I have Königsberg, I can still claim to the German people that East Prussia is not lost," end quote, Hitler explained in private. On the Czech frontier, the tough General Ferdinand Schirner fought a 20-day defensive battle for the industrial city of Moravian Ostrava, which ended on April 3rd in a convincing victory. Schirner said Hitler to Goebbels, was, quote, one hell of a fellow. You can, the kind you can blindly rely on, end quote. He appointed him field marshal. During the first week of April, this optimism was severely shaken. On April 2nd, Dr. Karl Brandt privately warned Hitler that national stocks of two-fifths of all essential medical items would run out completely in 2 months. This put the shortest time fuse yet on Hitler's strategy. Without medicines, disease and epidemic would cut his people down. Now that the Ruhr and Saar arsenals had been overrun, crippling production shortages in weapons, small arms, ammunition, and explosives made a mockery of his efforts to raise divisions from the Hitler Youth or Reich Labor Service battalions. At his midday war conference on April 1st, Hitler had expressly laid down, quote, "Anybody retreating in Austria is to be shot," end quote. During the afternoon of April 5th, however, General Otto Wöhler's Army Group South retreated 50 miles. Bormann jotted in his diary, quote, "The Bolsheviks are outside Vienna," end quote. Hitler merely sacked the general and replaced him with Lothar Rendulic, the gritty general who had just thwarted Stalin's last assault on the Courland Army Group. One of Bormann's party officials had telephoned that night, quote, "None of the Army Group gentlemen," meaning Wöhler's staff, "has the slightest faith in their ability to hold back the enemy from penetrating the Zirsdorf petroleum fields, nor, in fact, and this I must state plainly, do they believe that we can still win. The Luftwaffe blew up all of Vienna's searchlight sites on the night of April 3rd without a word to the Army Group. Zirsdorf outside Vienna was Hitler's only remaining source of petroleum. Vienna itself seemed bent on suicide. From there, SS Colonel Scorsese reported that while tank brigades were running out of gasoline, retreating Luftwaffe units were passing through with truckloads of girls and furniture. Professor Morell noted that since late March, Hitler had hardly set foot outside, just visiting an upper floor of the Reich Chancellery once a day for a meal. Quote, "Even the main daily war conference has been held for some time now down in the bunker for security reasons, as the Führer told me," end quote. In Berlin, the air was choked with flying dust and the smell of burning. The tremor in both hands was more marked than ever, and both eyes red-rimmed with conjunctivitis. On April 7th, a famous eye doctor, Professor Lolin, came to treat him. He determined that the right eye's vision had deteriorated still further, while the left eyelid was growing a chalazion, an irritating swelling that might have to be surgically removed. Quote, "There is a secretion from both eyes of late," noted the professor, "which is understandable in view of the dusty atmosphere in the center of Berlin. The Führer generally leaves the well-ventilated and illuminated bunker only for short periods, for half an hour to 2 hours daily, and then goes into the Reich Chancellery's garden, which is not badly damaged, but is of course quite dusty, particularly when windy. He finds himself then very sensitive both to light and the dust-laden wind. It is difficult to arrange a set treatment in view of the irregularity of his existence, and the need for him to be constantly available for reports, etc." End quote. Lolin prescribed warm compresses for the left eye. All the doctors, Lolin, Morell, and Stumpfeger, noticed that during the examination of his retina, Hitler kept his left hand quite still. The left leg's tremor also ceased. Morell diagnosed these tremors as the first symptoms of Parkinson's disease, and on April 8th he began electrogalvanic therapy. Quote, "This morning," he recorded on the 9th, "the war conference did not end until 5:30 in the morning, and that was followed by tea. Let's hope there's no early morning air raid alert so he gets enough time to sleep properly. End quote. Stalin's big Oder offensive might begin any day. General Theodor Busse was confident that his 9th Army Group could stop it from reaching Berlin. The Soviet forces were not so overwhelming in numbers that they were in material strength. Tens of thousands of Russian guns and rocket launchers waited mutely on the Oder's higher eastern bank overlooking the German positions. Yet Hitler was confident of a defensive victory. Hitler, in fact, believed that the buildup before Berlin was only a feint and that the real thrust would first be toward Prague. Stalin must surely intend to embrace the important Czech industrial region before his American rivals could reach it. Hitler had chided General Guderian, quote, "The Russians won't be as stupid as us. We were dazzled by our nearness to Moscow and just had to capture the capital. Remember, Guderian, you were the one who wanted to be the first into Moscow at the head of your army, and just look at the consequences." End quote. Whether this was intuition or on general staff advice, the records do not disclose, but at this crucial juncture, he impulsively ordered General Busse to relinquish 4 SS Panzer divisions to Schirner's army group defending Czechoslovakia. Hitler summoned General Heinrichi to the bunker again on April 4th, and together they subjected the Oder defenses to scrutiny. He reminded Heinrichi of the need to lay down deadly minefields at the obvious Schwerpunkt positions. He ordered the 9th Army to drive tunnels into the strategically crucial Silo Heights, which commanded the marshy valley west of Kustrin, through which the Russian attack must advance, to protect the Army's reserves from enemy artillery. He warned him against, quote, "Seydlitz officers," unquote, infiltrating in German uniforms. Behind the main front line, thousands of trees were being felled and anti-tank trenches dug. By April 11th, American forces had reached the Elbe at Magdeburg, only 60 miles from Berlin. Hitler was told that a Russian deserter had revealed that the Oder offensive would begin in 4 days' time. Again, he asked for a complete report on Heinrichi's army group. The generals assured him that no other sector in Germany was so well provided with troops and artillery. He congratulated Heinrichi's officers, quote, "The Russians are going to suffer their bloodiest defeat ever," end quote. One thing was certain. He could not fight a long battle of attrition because his stocks of aviation fuel would keep the Luftwaffe airborne for only a few days. And as the quartermaster general warned explicitly on April 15th, all munitions supplies would shortly cease. The factories were in enemy hands. Quote, There may shortly occur the most momentous consequences for our entire war effort, the general had warned, while being careful not to spell them out. End quote. As American troops advanced across Thuringia, Hitler was confronted with the problem of the big concentration camps like Buchenwald. Goering advised him to turn them over intact and under guard to the Western Allies, thus preventing hordes of embittered ex-convicts from roaming the countryside and inflicting additional horrors on the law-abiding. Hitler did not share Goering's naive trust in the enemy. Sitting casually on the edge of the map table after one war conference, he instructed Himmler's representative to ensure that all inmates who could not be evacuated were liquidated. Nor had he forgotten his special, quote-unquote, hostage collection of prominent prisoners held. On April 8th, prison officials loaded them aboard prison vans for transfer to the south. There was a kaleidoscope of famous names, Kurt Schuschnigg and his family, General Thomas, Dr. Schacht, General Halder, Molotov's nephew, Captain S. Payne Best, the British intelligence officer kidnapped in Venlo, Holland in November 1939, and Colonel Boguslav von Bonnen. These were the fortunate ones, because behind them, at Flossenbürg camp, they left the traitors Admiral Canaris and General Oster. A few days before, General Bulle had stumbled by chance on the long-sought secret diaries of Canaris, and these sealed the Abwehrchef's fate. He and General Oster were hanged after a summary court-martial on the 9th. A vague notion of continuing the war from the easily defended mountain regions of Bohemia, Bavaria, and northern Italy had begun to crystallize in Hitler's brain. When Galater Franzhofer came from the Tyrol on April 9th, he urged Hitler to abandon most of northern Italy, arguing that the only arms production of any significance came from the South Tyrol, The Fuhrer pointed out that virtually the entire arms effort now relied on the electro-steel supplied by northern Italy. Late on April 10th, he ordered Karl Otto Sohr, Speer's de facto successor, as armaments minister, to investigate the possibility of creating an independent arms industry in the Alps. If, as seemed likely, the remaining Reich was cut in two, Admiral Dönitz and Field Marshal Kesselring would rule the Northern and Southern Reich respectively. Briefing Kesselring at length late on April 12th, Hitler talked of General Busse's coming great victory on the Oder, of his new secret weapons, of the 12th Army he was raising under General Wenck to defeat the Allies on the Elbe, and of the coming rupture between Stalin and the West. General Busse shared Hitler's confidence. Quote, "If need be, we'll stand fast and here until the if need be, we'll stand fast here until the Americans are kicking us in the arse," end quote, he said, earthily expressing his strategic convictions to Goebbels that evening. And the propaganda minister assured Busse's more skeptical staff that if there was any justice, some miracle would surely save the Reich, just as in 1762. With gentle irony, an officer inquired, quote, "Which Tsarina is going to die then?" end quote. All along the Oder, a troublesome Russian artillery activity had just begun. The news of President Franklin D. Roosevelt's sudden death on April 12th in Warm Springs, Georgia, reached Hitler that night. Goebbels telephoned, his voice shrill with excitement. Quote, "This is the turning point." All Hitler's ministers agreed that God had wrought a swift and terrible judgment on their hated enemy. The next morning, the Fuhrer began dictating his last famous proclamation to his soldiers on the Eastern Front. Quote, "For one last time," it began, "our mortal enemies, the Jewish Bolsheviks, are throwing their weight into the attack," end quote. He issued the proclamation to the army groups that night. It closed with a reference to Roosevelt. Quote, "At this moment, when fate has carried off the greatest war criminal of all times from the face of this earth, the war's turning point has come," end quote. He seemed to have shut his eyes to the possibility that Berlin itself might become a battlefield. But late on April 13, 1945, when Ribbentrop spoke with him, he gave permission for the nervous diplomatic corps to leave the capital for southern Germany. The next day, the shelling of Busse's positions increased, and 200 Russian tanks launched attacks up to regimental strength. 98 tanks were destroyed. April 15th brought a lull. It was on this day that Eva Braun unexpectedly arrived back in Berlin, having evidently hitched a truck ride up from Bavaria. She intended to die with him. Some of his male staff also found the decision to remain at Hitler's side until the inevitable end comparatively easy. The last letter, which his personal adjutant Alvin Broder Albrecht now wrote to his wife, admitted, however, quote, "It is certainly hard for us men to stand in our last battle far from our families, knowing that our wives and children will later have to face the trials of life alone. But hundreds of thousands of others have found the strength, and I am trying to set an example, however humble, to all my compatriots," end quote. During the night, General Wenck's new army succeeded in destroying one American bridgehead on the Elbe south of Magdeburg and in reducing another. A Russian prisoner taken south of Kustrin revealed, however, that Stalin's big Oder offensive would begin the next morning. He spoke of a colossal artillery barrage and of mighty new tanks and howitzers standing by, and he reported that the troops had been ordered to wash and shave every day, quote, "to make a cultivated impression," unquote, from now on. This detail gave the report the ring of authenticity. Hitler ordered Busse's Ninth Army pulled back into the secret second line of defense. At his midnight conference, he learned with stabbing misgivings of a puzzling request by General Heinrichi for permission to transfer his army group HQ to a new site, which Hitler found to be to the rear of Berlin and thus behind the Führer's own headquarters. There's an asterisk. In defiance of the orders he had accepted from Hitler, Heinrichi had secretly decided that if his Oder front collapsed, he would abandon Berlin to the enemy without even the pretense of a fight. Speer claimed to have brought about Heinrichi's remarkable decision. He flatly forbade such a transfer. At 5 a.m. the next morning, April 16th, a mighty Russian artillery barrage began all along the Oder and Neisse rivers. Nearly half a million shells thundered down on the now virtually abandoned German forward positions. At 6:30 a.m., Marshal Zhukov's tanks and infantry began pouring across both sides of the Frankfurt on Oder strongpoint until held by Busse's Ninth Army. An hour later, the main assault on the 4th Panzer Army defending the Nysa front began. The German Air Force threw all it had into the battle. In a second unsung kamikaze operation, 60 Luftwaffe planes manned by suicide pilots crash-bombed the Oder bridges across which the enemy was flooding westward. By nightfall, although a 5 mile deep breach had been torn into the front near Riesen, there was no doubt in the chancellery that Hitler's generals had inflicted a resounding defeat on the enemy. His secretary Christa Schroeder asked timidly whether they would now be leaving Berlin. Hitler answered most resentfully, quote, "No, calm down. Berlin will always be German." End quote. Not so much. The secretary replied that she regarded her life as spent already. Quote, "But I can't quite see how it's all going to end, with the Americans coming closer every day on one side and the Russians on the other." End quote. Quote, "Time," explained Hitler. We've just got to gain time." End quote. And end chapter. That's the second to last. One more.